You're listening to the Backstage Pass podcast, hosted by Hannah Trigwell and brought to you by Tommen.
Hello, Tom Gray.
Hello, Hannah, how are you?
Hello. I'm good, how are you?
Yeah, you know, I'm all right. I'm hot.
We did just say we were hot. It is a very hot day.
It's an extraordinarily hot day.
It is, and you've been very busy with meetings, as you were saying.
Yes, I have been very, very busy with many, many meetings, politicians and groups and humans, all, and journalists.
Do you feel talked out about that, or can you give us some info?
No, I can. I'm very happy to talk about it. The funny thing is that I've also got like two music jobs on at the moment, so it's a bit strange because I'm having to sort of switch left brain, right brain all the time.
Let's talk about this campaign because I think because I'm in the UK, I feel like my perception of it is I'm very aware of it because of everything that I've seen online, but I don't know if everybody else will. So
sure,
break it down for us.
Well, it's basically that. I should explain. I apart from being in a band called Gomez for many years and writing music for TV and stuff. And theatre. I'm also a director of the PRS for Music, the collection society in the UK, and I work with writer composer organisations like the Ivors Academy, who I work on their policy unit and their songwriter committee, and I represent the Featured Artist Coalition as well as a writer artist advocate. That's a mouthful. And work a bit with the MU as well, so I'm very across everything. I wouldn't say I'm an authority on these things, but I certainly feel like I'm very wise to trends that are happening in remuneration and how basically we're all getting paid and what that looks like. And so I was kind of I'm sitting there at the beginning of COVID, going, "Good God, this is going to have a shocking effect," because obviously if you lose live income and that keeps going and we don't even know when that'll ever come back, and you lose licensing income because all the bars and restaurants and hairdressers are closed and advertising revenue will go down because the economy's going to go down. The PROs like PRS are going to get a massive drop in their income, and that's so everyone's PRS checks or gamer checks or SASM checks or wherever you are in the world, those checks are going to go down. And it's going to, the innate inequity, the sort of the horrific way that streaming pays is going to be laid absolutely bare. And it's going to, and people are going to get progressively more angry about it. So I need to get in front of that and start talking about it now and giving people the facts as best I can to try and educate people about how the deals are done, where their rights lie, and how they've basically been stiffed and are continuing to be stiffed. So that people have got somewhere to direct that frustration. That was basically the shape of it, and that's how it's progressed, and it's sort of, you know, gotten an awful lot of traction. There's a lot of UK MPs have spoken about it, asked questions in Parliament. Everyone from the BPI, which is the major labels, have had to respond to it. Bjorn from ABBA spoke about it in the press.
Wow!
Yeah, I mean, it's a curious thing that you can just start talking, and people listen. I've worked for several years in the background in these organisations, not taking a lead on anything. So it's been curious becoming the sort of the sort of head of it, the sort of spit, you know. It's also not the I'm a classic sideman in the band I'm in as well. I'm like I'm not that guy, right? So
how did it go from, I mean, that there must have been so many steps, you know, from going from being in a band to the position you're in now, sort of, as you say, heading up the Broken Record campaign?
I mean, it probably predates it, really. I started off studying politics and being very engaged in politics as a kid. So I came through sort of Labour Party politics in the UK in the early 90s. And then I was about to go and work. I had an internship to work in Washington. I forget what year that would have been. 1996, 97, something like that. So I was going to go and work for a senator and be a speechwriter. That was my thing. I wanted to be a speechwriter.
Wow.
That's what I've always I've always loved words. I love writing and I wanted to be a speechwriter. I thought that's a great thing. I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then the lads who I'd grown up with, who we'd like recorded, we were self-recordists, hobbyist recordists, who would make C90 Fostex four-track tapes of our music we wrote when we were stoned. Suddenly got offered like 25 record deals.
Wow.
And, you know, got to the point where Madonna was trying to fly us over to Los Angeles in a private jet. And
oh, God. Wow.
From this little C90 cassette. And then my life went on a completely different journey. We won the Mercury Prize with most of what was on that C90 cassette. And then in the early noughties, we kind of became a serious touring band in the United States. And I toured probably nonstop in America from about 2002 to 2011.
Yeah, they say that when you tour America, you have to really be there for a long time. Is that
Oh, yeah, true? No, 100%. If you want to crack it, if you want to be like, I mean, at one point we were in like the top 30 grossing bands in America because we were just playing every day. I think one year we played 240 shows in a year. So it was a life lived. And eventually about 2012, yeah, when the record industry was absolutely on its knees and it all just felt like, what's the point? Just decided to hang my touring boots up for a while. And because it was just like, I've got to get off the party bus at some point, you know.
Touring's so intense, isn't it? It's like a world of its own.
Absolutely. I sort of got into composing for TV, did like a big children's TV show, got involved with theatre people, just started investigating what else I could do. Because I love songwriting, you know, songwriting's really my thing, is my craft. You know, that's if someone's asked me what I was, I'd say I was a songwriter. Never really enjoyed performing live enormously. I get quite a lot of stage fright and I've always had to sort of overcome that.
I'm exactly the same as that.
Yeah.
Definitely feel more comfortable in a studio. It is good fun touring and I love playing shows, but it's almost like you can't be honest about the fact that sometimes it's really hard and you know, you're up there being you, the you that people see and the musician side of you, but then there's the stage nerves and, you know, actually where I'm honest with myself and where I'm most comfortable is in the studio, but that's not a very sexy thing to say.
I don't know. I think it's a really sexy thing to say. I think that actually the creative side of it is why I want to be involved in it. I don't want to be involved. Stage performance is about refining something so that it gets more and more perfect. But the problem with it is, and this is
that's true.
This is what they don't tell you. And at one point we got so good that, like, actually we felt like we'd gone out, like, down the other side. We'd gone past the moment when we were best because we'd become so rehearsed and so, like, not even rehearsed from actually, just, like, we could smash it every single time. And, like, it's just, like, and it was great because, you know, hordes of people would show up to see us all in every city in America, but, it's also curious because you kind of feel like you're on autopilot and it's not the thing that the thrill of having a brilliant idea and realizing it and having a vision that's music to me. Having to sort of turn on the charm and the energy every night is brutal, as you know. You know, it's sometimes you just want to be a miserable cat and
yeah, that's true. Do you get that feeling from, you know, the feeling of realizing your vision? Have you had that through this Broken Record campaign? Do you get a similar feeling like that?
Yeah, it's a similar sort of a thing because, yeah, you can sort of see where the pieces are sitting. You have to think, and it's in many ways, yeah, I think I'm very much like a producer kind of brain. I really like strategies, and I really like kind of pulling focus and being able to see the big picture, you know, and addressing that. And yeah, I think campaigning, especially in the position I'm in where it's all me, is very like that, because I can just, if I have a sort of really a creative idea about people I can involve or, you know, or sort of places where I might be able to sort of apply pressure, especially in a sort of, I mean, this is political brain as well, but sort of in a, not to be too Machiavellian about it, but you know, that I do like sort of being able to sort of think about things asymmetrically and go, well, how can you get this to happen by pressing, how can you press down over here and this pops up? You know, I think that's really kind of, if you know what I'm talking about, there's something really creative about it. I also have to write a lot of copy as well for this, so it allows me to, you know, wax lyrical, which which is the same, you know, it's the same thing. And I'm a people person, you know. I love meeting people and getting to know them, and that's, you know, that's probably served me better than anything else in my career, if I'm honest. Which is the bit they never really sort of tell you is that actually, if you're going to succeed in this business, it's going to be the relationships you form and the champions you find, and that's it, really.
Yeah, they don't say that, do they? They're just like, write the hit song.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that, I suppose I come from a very different headspace. I really didn't come from that kind of commercial songwriting thing. Okay. It was very much like, do whatever the hell you like. My band were just ridiculous, still are ridiculous. We just did what we wanted.
For people that aren't aware of the band, how would you describe them as?
God, like a car crash, we were sort of, I guess we're the sort of last band to really go to stick two fingers up at genre and go, nah, people don't need, I mean, the problem is right, everyone gets so professionalized by this industry, and I think that's really a massive shame, because you know, the reason why genre is really there is because it helps you find an audience, which means it helps you sell something, and as soon as that thought enters your mind, you've almost lost on some level, because what you obviously want to make music. Like, I love, the thing that thrills me the most is making music purely out of that compulsion to make it and just discover what happens. But whenever I think about the audience, it's never better. It curiously never improves anything that I do.
It makes it more difficult, if anything, doesn't it?
Yeah, you'll just get in your own way. And because the last thing the artist needs is a naysayer, right? People just need to freely express themselves, and hopefully there'll be something great will come out of it. You know, the great thing is you can just throw it away anyway, right? It's
that's true.
So
you can't always just throw it away at the end of the day and think, well, that's, someone said, It was actually originally something that Ed Sheeran had said about turning the tap on and letting the dirty water come through, and then at some point the clean comes, and it's that kind of thing, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah, yeah. It's just letting it happen and not getting in your own way.
Mm.
And steering clear of other people who get in your way as well. That's a big thing too, is not listening to too many voices, because it just doesn't help. The world doesn't need somebody who's listened to everybody else. They don't need that.
That's true.
They just want something else.
Are you able to write songs, you know, while you've got a focus on pushing this campaign as well?
I've got to. So yeah, I am doing. I mean, I've got two serious deadlines in front of me. So,
right.
With theatre projects. So I've just got to, like,
pull your finger out.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I've ever put it in, to be honest, Anna. But like, I have to write, like, in my day, I have to, like, say, like, these 2 hours are going to be me writing a song, and actually tell myself what song it's going to be as well.
And you just think, this is the kind of song, it's going to be this, and I'm going to write it between these 2 hours, go.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Do you find, sometimes does it just not work out, I imagine?
Yeah, of course, sometimes it doesn't work out, but, like, yeah. I think... A lot of writers, what you really need is a strategy and like to give yourself a brief.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, and that brief shouldn't be, like I say, it shouldn't be like, I write a hit, because that is not a brief. That is not a brief. It's
the world's vaguest brief.
Exactly, exactly. It's like, what is good about, like, or what is great about me in this moment, right? What would I say is thrilling me right now about myself, like the bit that I can see that gets me excited, what's that? And then sort of design around it and kind of go, okay, what story do I want to tell with that? And then that's usually how I do it, because it's just like, I get an idea in my head of something that excites me, and then I just want to arrive there, so I have to do the work in between to get from here to there.
Yeah.
I've always really, really wanted to be original. So I almost don't care what it is, as long as I don't feel like I've heard it before. That's always like the thing that excites me the most, because it's like, you know, you steal from everywhere, of course, but like it's how you confound that so that it's like, what is that? What is this homunculus I've created? This little monster, you know. That's really when it's thoroughly joyful for me.
Mm.
How do you approach it? How do you approach songwriting?
It either goes one of two ways. Either I've got a day set aside where I'm like, that's going to be a songwriting day. Do you know what I mean? Or it's like planned in, like a co-writing session with someone. But it's usually a whole day. So there's not really, I don't ever have much pressure time-wise to write. I don't think I've ever been in that situation, actually. And I'm interested to see how I would do in something like that, if it would make me write something amazing or something absolutely terrible. But yeah, it's either usually like, I'm going to write something on that day. Might take ideas from like a voice notes thing on my phone or something I've written down. Or to be fair, like 9 times out of 10, it's just something brand new and it's whatever I'm feeling on that day. Or I'm just trying to chill out, playing myself something that I don't know what it is. Like, you know, it's just happening sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm just playing guitar for the fun of it. And then and then something comes naturally, and then I'm like, oh, I should write that down. This is a song. I've never been very structured, I've never really guided myself in what I should do or what I wanted to do particularly, apart from just whatever the mood was on the day. But I've written to brief sometimes, and that's been fun, but not as fun.
Yeah.
As just doing whatever's natural. But I think that's just life in general, isn't
it? But did you write the brief?
No.
Now this is the point I'm making. Yeah. I'm not saying jump to somebody like don't do somebody else's brief. Write your own brief. Write your own brief. It's not structure. What it is limitation.
Right.
I'm a great believer in limitations, and that you are most creative when you are. It's like the bigger the sandbox gets, the more choices you have. So the less you'll do.
Yeah, I find that actually in everything. That's really true. So like a narrowing of focus.
Yeah, choice is actually an illusion. It's not healthy. You know, it's important that we're free, you know, that's important, yeah. Obviously, but this idea that freedom is the cause of great things happening doesn't follow at all. In fact, it's like, you know, some of the most, you know, the thing that made me have success was learning how to record on a 4-track machine, you know, and like having to do these incredible like mathematical charts me and Ian used to do when we were kids, like working out how we'd bounce everything and keep everything. So we'd record a whole band on to 4 tracks and then split it and then, you know, and,
wow.
You know, and stuff like that. And like, you know, whereas now obviously you can just keep adding new track, add new track,
yeah.
Add new track.
200 stems.
Yeah, leave it to the mixer.
Yeah. Oh, mixers have a hard time now, you know.
I know, because people should just make decisions. It's like, it's the same thing, right? If you say a meeting is an hour and a half long, a meeting will take an hour and a half. If you say a meeting is if you say a meeting is 20 minutes long, you'll do the exact same amount of work.
What's that? Is it principles law or something?
Yeah,
it begins with a P.
I forget what it's called. Yeah, but it's the same thing.
Yeah, but yeah,
it's the same thing.
Yeah,
if you're sitting in the studio in your like 48-hour co-write, whatever, and you've written the song and you've done the parts, you're like, you know what, we should just stick another 50 harmonies on that and just try and alt.
Oh, it's so true.
It's like, stop it. Just stop doing it. It's either good or it's bad. You're not going to make it any better. It's just, yeah, no, I couldn't. I've tried mixing stuff. And I end up getting angry with my friends. I'm just like, I'm sorry, this is just nonsense. you've not made any decisions. There are really huge benefits in saying to yourself, I'm not going to record more than 5 tracks. I'm not going to, you know, it has to happen in a melody and a single harmony. It has to be like one instrument and a beat. I want to write this kind of a song. And I want it to have, you know, have this kind of a feeling. Go,
yeah,
you know, because that's it, you know.
I remember the first time I was playing on just opened a Logic project, and I mean, my God, layering tiny little percussive things on top of each other, thinking, oh, that's cool because that sounds different, and then. And then add in this and put in the tiny bit of that in there. But does it really add anything? But the paranoia that taking it out would ruin the song, it just gets crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah. You just have to stop that mode of thinking, I think. It's so funny now, especially when you listen to what most pop look sounds like and there's just nothing happening. And you're like, wait a minute. I mean, How is it that people are getting delivering 200 tracks of audio to mixes, and then you hear their single and it's like a synth, a bass and a vocal, and you're like, how, what did, am I missing something?
My mixing engineer for the first album that I did, I remember being in the mixing session with him, and he's really great, and he knows what's essential and what's not. And he was just deleting things left, right, and center. And I was like, he's like, well, it doesn't add anything. So you take it out, listen to it now. Do you miss it? No. Good. Carry on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. So what I'm just saying is that you'd be surprised how much you can achieve in 2 hours if you aren't like trying to ice the cake.
Do you do production as well?
I've always done production, but I just think it's the same thing. Starting off as a self-recordist,
yeah,
it was about the outcome. It was like, how come, you know, how can you record a song that sounds like weird and wonky? You know, what? Let's record a weird and wonky song. You know, which is, you know, we did a lot of, really.
Yeah.
You know, so that's. But yeah, so I am, yeah. And of course, with the like TV music, that's all production, really, because it's all textural, you know, nowadays. You know, if it's not like strings and stuff, if it's, you know, synth beds and stuff that needs to get out of the way of dialogue and, you know,
yeah,
that whole mode of thinking. But yeah.
How did you get into the other side of it? You know, now being a director for PRS?
I suppose about 3 years ago, I was chatting to some mates, and I it occurred to me many times that there can't be many people who have a full, who've had a long career in the music business and have sort of a lot of connections in the world of politics. And I just kind of went, am I gonna?
It's gonna be me.
It's gonna be me.
Someone's gotta do it.
Somebody's gotta take one for the team. May as well be this asshole. Yeah, yeah. That's kind of how it happened.
Really?
Really.
Brilliant.
And you know, lots of, because people had pushed me to for ages and had said, you know, you should really do this, man. And I was like, all right. Because, you know, I'm opinionated and I'm thoughtful, hopefully. And, yeah, I think I've got a strong voice when I'm in those rooms. And I'm not intimidated by, you know, people who work for major labels. And because I've been dealing with them my whole life. It's just like, same shit, different day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's fine. I think it's appropriate that I'm doing it, and more so now with a campaign like this, where I'm really going, okay, let's call in all of those favors with all of those different people who've just become friends or acquaintances over the years in politics and music, and saying, let's put this all together. Thus far, it works. You know, I can get the meetings that I want to get, and people, you know, want to listen. You know, and it's been really interesting talking to all kinds of. You know, got a meeting with the Shadow Culture Secretary this week. I've got a meeting with the World Economic Forum. Some talks about speaking to the UN about it, which is bizarre.
Wow.
And then there's like lots of people behind closed doors who can't say that they support it, but do support it and want.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. We should probably talk about that. It's a lot of young artists who, especially, I mean, there's people in the industry too who won't say that they support it, but do. But a lot of young artists who feel that if they speak up about this stuff, they won't get streamed. They won't get, you know, New Music Friday or whatever it is that everyone chases after these days. I sound like an old git, don't I? and And I'm trying to say to them, don't worry about that cost. That these companies are so big, they don't notice. They don't care. Half of the streaming platforms want things to change. They don't, you know, they're in the deals that they're in. You know.
Have you spoken to the streaming? Have they spoken to you directly?
I am in contact with people at streaming services. Yeah. And some of them...
That's good, because I wondered whether it was just, you know, whether they were listening.
They're very much listening. I mean, I forget the name of the woman who... There's an organisation who represent loads of them, and she made a speech and talked about it. They're very aware. I mean, I'd be worried if I was them, because, you know, there are going to be... This is going to go on. And, you know, it's not... People might be okay-ish now, but when the government in the UK, when the government self-employment allowances and stuff disappear, and all the live money from people's bank accounts is gone, it's going to get. I mean, we it's going to get desperate, and I don't think people have really mentally prepared themselves for that.
Bands or artists now. Who are putting their songs on these streaming sites. From your point of view, do you think that they should carry on doing that but make noise about the fact that the rave pays very low per stream and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd say is, look, think about the kinds of deals that you do. Don't sign a life of copyright deal. Don't do it. Don't ever do that. Don't sign a recoupment deal anymore. If you believe in your work, don't go for the advance. Try and get the money out of the system by putting it in and keeping as many of the rights as you possibly can. That's what you should be doing, right? That's where we're at a point in history, you know. Then when it comes to, as an independent artist, getting your music out there, if you've already got fans, I mean, it's much harder if you're a completely emerging artist, but if you've already got fans, think of it like this. It's like hardback, paperback, lending library, right? This is how I always describe it. Hardback is physical sales to your fans. So, and people do buy physical still. And so you can manufacture something, you can sell t-shirts, you can do that. That's the way you're going to make the most money is D2C selling physical stuff.
Yeah.
Then there's paperback, which is like Bandcamp, which is monetizable digitization. So, but what you've got to do is you've got to do this first for a period of time before you go onto the digital platform. So you have to have, that's why the book companies sell the hardback for a while before they make it a paperback, right? It's because what you're not doing is cannibalizing the value by putting it all together. So so it has to, you know, you sell your physical, then you go to digitization, paid digitization, and then like Bandcamp or wherever, and you tell your fans about it and you get them to buy from you there. And it's only after you've had a period of time where you feel like you've got value from your actual fans, that's when you let it go to the lending library, right? Which is basically what the streaming platforms are. So what you, because if you let it go straight to the streaming, you're going to have to let some music go to the streaming sites, because unbelievably radio stations and things like that won't play a song unless it's on Spotify. So yeah, the single's going to have to go on Spotify. I'm not saying there aren't caveats to this, but once the music is on Spotify, like a whole album or whatever, if it goes on at the same time as it goes on there, as it goes on Bandcamp and it goes to physical, you're just cannibalizing all of the value in your actual fans, because they'll just go and listen to it for free on Spotify, right?
Yeah,
it's just gone. So you have to think like that, and you have to think about, as best you can, is to think strategically. And if you are working with a label, get them to think more strategically, because people don't realize how, you know, especially if a label's got a lot of releases, they just aren't necessarily thinking about it. They'll just kind of stick it out in the wind and hope for the best, especially if they haven't got much of a marketing budget. I think there's a way of approaching it so that you minimize the damage to the value of your work. but still engage with it. Because I'm not anti-streaming, far from it. I use streaming. Love streaming. Streaming has massively improved our ability to do, you know, music discovery. When I was like 20, I would look for records. It would take me like 3 years to find a record. I remember in particular, I was trying to get hold of Star Sailor by Tim Buckley, right? And that record was the most, it was just like, it didn't exist. It was like, it was a record that people said had come out, but it didn't exist. Yeah. And then finally got a copy, I think, in Record Collector in Sheffield. And it was like, it's a horrible record. Don't listen to that record. I mean, it's Tim Buckley when he's...
After all that.
It's when Tim Buckley's on maximum heroin and has just lost the plot and it's just, like, not good. That's an aside. Now I want to hear Star Sailor by Tim Buckley. I just type Star Sailor Tim Buckley into a streaming site and it's just and it's just there instantaneously. Unbelievable. Yeah. What an incredible thing that is. That, you know... But what we do have to fix is how it pays, because we can't. It's just too rubbish. And the EU, you know, the EU just tried to do. I've just put out a really important directive on copyright called the EU Copyright Directive, which we fought long and hard to get, which has protections in it for artists to get your record company audited. It has a revocation of rights protection in it so that you can get your rights back from record companies if they aren't exploiting you. It has, what else is in there? It has a right to fair remuneration as well. Now, and it was going to get rid of, like, safe harbor from YouTube, so YouTube were going to have to start properly paying for music, right?
Yeah.
We fought so hard to get it, and now the UK government aren't doing it. Don't know how it got lost along the way. It's just, it's really crazy, actually. You know, so this is why I'm constantly speaking to creators and just saying, you know, don't think it doesn't matter. Don't think that you can't be heard, because, you know, you're a citizen like anyone else. And when you speak to a policymaker or a legislator, they have to listen, because you're one of their constituents. You know, they have to listen.
It's really interesting to, you know, to hear about everything that's happening with Broken Record, because I see it, you know, and to be able to just talk to you about it and get your unfiltered thoughts about it is great. I'm just sad that we've come to the end of the time.
Thanks
so much for speaking to me about this. It's been really good.
Absolute pleasure.
What is your track of the week?
My track of the week. It's, I can't remember the name of it. I've been listening to it a bit. It's the first single off the new Blake Mills album.
Okay.
You'll have to find it. Because I can't think of it. It's really interesting. Blake Mills' new album's really like, I think he's great. A really interesting producer, and he's just an amazing guitar player. I think his guitar playing is all over the new Bob Dylan record, if I'm not mistaken. His new record's much weirder, and there's sort of touches of hard to describe, really. Touches of like maybe this is left brain, right brain. You see, this is what happens. This is what happens. You know, like Spirit of Eden. What's that band called? Laughing Stock. There's touches of that about it, and touches of like mid-70s John Martin and stuff. It's good. It's really interesting. Sorry, is that a good enough answer? I don't feel like I answered it in any way straightforwardly.
The first track from the new Blake Mills album.
Yeah.
That's a good enough answer for me.
Well, it was the sort of one that was sort of put out as the single. I forget what it was called. I've only had it for a week. You know, it's hard to learn the titles of songs. Isn't
it? I don't blame you.
I feel like you're judging me, Hannah. I feel like you're judging me.
Songwriting is very important, but whatever. It's fine. No, I don't blame you. I'm gonna check it out though. The first track of the new Blake Mills.
Just the whole Blake Mills album. Just listen to that.
The whole album.
Yeah, the whole thing. It's really cool, interesting record.
And what is the best lesson that you've learnt in your career so far? Another big question.
I think it's something that I alluded to earlier, which is find your champions. That's the trick. The trick is to find your champions. If you find them, hold on to them and be very loyal to them, because people who will go into battle for you and sing your praises, they're the defining people in your career. No question about it.
I agree.
Good. Thank you, Hannah.
Yeah.
Have I won your favour back now after my
yes.
appalling song of the week answer?
No, but the thing is about the answer is that I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to forget that answer, am I? So I will be checking that song out. And sometimes someone will say, do you check this song out? And you're like, yeah, I'll check it out. But sometimes you don't get around to it. And with this, it's just going to be in my head now. What's it called?
Oh,
What is it?
What?
So, yeah, I'll find that out. But thanks so much. It's been great to speak to you.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Take care of yourself, won't you?
You too. Thanks for tuning in to this episode. Be sure to hit subscribe and leave a comment to let us know what you think. And I will see you next time on Backstage Pass.